When fire takes everything you own, where do you go? That question is on the minds of more than 10,000 families who've lost their homes in the Camp Fire in the Sierra Nevada foothills of Northern California. More than 70 people have been found dead so far, and more than 1,000 people have been reported missing. And the town of Paradise and the surrounding area are almost completely destroyed. A humanitarian crisis is unfolding. Some survivors are staying with friends and family. Others managed to get whatever remaining hotel rooms they could. Many shelters in the area are at capacity. And still others have been left without any place to stay, suffering through cold nights in cars or tents. This weekend, President Donald Trump visited victims of the devastating Woolsey Fire near Los Angeles and survivors of the mass shooting at the Borderline Bar in Thousand Oaks. And he also went to Paradise to visit with the victims of the Camp Fire. But while there, he was criticized for his approach, including getting the town's name wrong. He called it Pleasure several times. But despite the president's visit, people who have lost everything in the Camp Fire are coming together, filling big box store parking lots and a local fairground and trying to figure out their next move. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And we begin our coverage today with Michelle Wiley reporting from Paradise, California and the surrounding area. Michelle's with KQED in San Francisco. Michelle, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So some people have been able to stay with friends or family, but how many people are without these resources? How many people do we know are homeless right now because of the fires?
I don't think that we have an exact estimate. And part of the issue is that there are a lot of people who are unaccounted for right now. Over the weekend, the sheriff announced that over 1,000 people are unaccounted for. So I think we're still trying to suss out exactly how widespread this is going to be. I know that over 10,000 residences burned. So that's a lot of displaced people. And there's only so many shelters that can put them up. So we're seeing a lot of people camping outside in Chico right now.
That's what I was going to ask you. We've heard about people going into parking lots, people trying to gather in different places. What have you seen? You said there are people camping.
Yeah. So I think probably what has gotten the most focus is that there is a large tent camp site right outside of a Walmart parking lot in downtown Chico. And there's a couple of reasons that people are out there. One of them is that there has been an outbreak of norovirus, which is a stomach bug that can have like flu-like symptoms, and it's been in the shelters. So people are a little bit nervous to go to a shelter. They're afraid they're going to get sick. Another reason is just, you know, some people just don't like the shelter system. Some of them have been homeless before, and they're uncomfortable with being in that sort of structured environment. So regardless of the reason, there are people camping right outside of this Walmart. There's a donation system. They have porta potties. They have food there. And officials are encouraging them to leave because they're worried that that area is going to flood when it rains later this week. But they're not forcing them to leave. So there are a significant number of people out there.
Where would some of these folks go, though?
So there are Red Cross shelters. FEMA is supposed to be setting up trailers. They're just trying to decide where they're going to be set up. I mean, it's a bit of a hodgepodge. Some people have friends they can stay with. Some people are going to hotels out in Gridley, which is about 30 minutes away. Some people are just trying to figure out their next steps. One of the biggest issues for people there is that their cars burned in the fire. A lot of people abandoned their vehicles on the road out to Paradise because the traffic was moving so slowly, they couldn't escape the fire fast enough. So for some, it's not even really an issue of money or where they need to go. They just have to find a way to get there.
And you've also spoken to people who are newly homeless. You spoke to one woman named Christina Hickson. Let's hear what she had to say.
I heard in Yuba City, they're putting people in apartments. If you go to the shelter there, and we signed up for FEMA. We've done all that stuff. We've been saving gift cards to get a motel. We figure even if we're in a motel, we can still utilize the services of the shelter, they said, you know, and go there during the day. We just, and when you get a lot of people, like, I don't know how I got sick. You know, I guess this norovirus is going around, stomach flu. I've been sick all night, very sick.
Is Christina's story typical?
I would say yes. I think for a lot of people there, once they lost their homes, they sort of found themselves with not exactly sure what the next step was. And I think for her, like you heard, she has a couple different options that she's considering. But I think it also really underscores the way that people feel about these shelters.
this is, you know, California has had issues with housing for a while before this disaster happened. And you spoke to people who were homeless before the campfire.
I've been homeless 24 years, and homelessness doesn't bother me at all. I'm used to it. You know, it's the fact of seeing my friends, my loved ones, my community, everything is gone. We drove through paradise, and I can't believe it.
Michelle, the trauma in that man's voice is so evident, especially for someone who said this doesn't bother him, but it's seeing everyone else around him. Is that also something you found?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, in sort of the way they feel after this kind of disaster, they're so concerned about their friends, their relatives, their neighbors, that more of what I heard than them being upset over their own situation was being worried about the people around them, if they were going to find a good place to go.
One of the things that always strikes me about these horrible disasters is the resilience of the people who are often involved. You spoke to somebody named Mark Setchell, and here's what he had to say.
It's going to be a long road, and it's going to be a rough one. But the people of Paradise are strong. I've seen the community come together in an awesome way here. And now we'll be able to rebuild Paradise. It's going to take a long time, and it's going to be rough. But I know I'm going to rebuild.
Michelle, this is another very emotional interview, and a lot of the folks in Paradise are also low income. Can you give us a sense of how that's impacting what happens?
I mean, as you can imagine, it makes things even more difficult. A lot of people there don't have the kind of financial support that you would need in a situation like this where you're newly homeless or continuing with homelessness, but you're out suddenly in a place that you're unfamiliar with, where you're not familiar with the area, you don't know what really where you should be, how you can get anywhere. I think that the impact of the incident alone is so devastating. And then when you bring in the fact that a lot of these people are sort of trapped in this situation, it's hard to leave the area. It really compounds things. And, you know, what Mark said, I think, is illustrative of how people there are feeling. It's a really mixed bag. Some people are feeling really resilient. They're Paradise strong. They're ready to rebuild their community. And some people don't want to go back. They don't want to go back there because it was so traumatic. And there have been so many devastating losses there, from the number of people missing to the number of people who've been found dead.
Michelle Wiley is a reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Michelle, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
After a natural disaster, there's one population that always tugs on our human heartstrings: the animals. Since the campfire, firefighters and other people have found hundreds of animals who've survived, and Facebook groups have sprung up to help people get reunited with their pets or find new homes. And among the hundreds of stories, we have one story of a lost pet we'd like to share with all of you.
I'm Laura Smith.
And I am Chris Smith. I lived in Paradise since 2005.
But not anymore.
On the morning of Thursday, November 8th, Laura was in Milwaukee for a business trip, and Chris had dropped off his younger son at his high school in nearby Chico. But on his way back to Paradise, Chris quickly realized he had to evacuate their home with his older son, Harrison.
We put our dog, Lucy, who's a little chewy dog, in the car. We put our cat, Peanut, in the car, and then our cat, Kermit, in the car. In the midst of putting in the last stuff, we began to hear some big blasting sounds far off in the distance. Apparently, at that point, some of the propane tanks in town were starting to explode. And then around that point, our cat Kermit somehow got out of the car and ran first to our porch. My son Harrison and I, we tried to corral Kermit, but he was getting a little scared. We were trying to be calm. We were trying to be careful, but, you know, between the blasting sounds and the sounds of the fire and Harrison and I being tense, I think Kermit just took off, and at that point I began to worry that we were going to get to a situation where there was going to be no real visibility for us to be able to drive safely. So I said to Harrison, you know, I'm sorry, but we were just going to have to go now, and that's it.
The next day, Chris and the boys picked up Laura from the airport, and soon they were all reunited, except for Kermit.
We were pretty torn up. It was one of those situations where we knew we made the right decision. We knew we made the safe decision, but it was an awful decision.
You know, we all said if there was ever a cat that could make it through this, it was Kermit. But, you know, it was painful for all of us to not know where he was or what was going on with him. But we all said that we missed him and that we hoped he was good.
You know, you hear about a house getting washed away or burned or something, and then the cat is there 2 weeks later just waiting or whatever. You hear about this stuff, but then the more I heard about the ferocity of the fire, the more I heard about what happened, at least to myself, I was getting more and more pessimistic.
But then late last week, Chris, who's a video producer, went back to Paradise to film some footage of the wreckage with CAL FIRE officials. He persuaded one fire official to swing by his house, and that's where he heard a familiar sound.
I had walked halfway down the driveway and called out twice, "Hey, Kermit, you know, here, kitty, kitty, kitty.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Kitty, 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 kitty."
And then I heard a very loud meow. Starting to, you know, and then I walked over and it was just,
"Come here, Kermit."
It was almost like Kermit was yelling at me. It was like really, like really persistent, really like over and over and over.
"Hey, Kermit. Hey. Sorry. I know. I know."
It was almost like he was really telling me off, really telling me, like, "Why'd you leave me?" You know, I'm of course projecting, but kind of like, "Why'd you leave me? Where'd you go? You guys have been gone for, have you seen what happened to the house? Oh my God, what's going, you know." Like, this cat was really talking to me.
He must have seen some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
The full family, including Kermit, were finally reunited that day.
I just cried so hard when Chris got back with him. He just looked so scared and but so tough and so brave.
Kermit had lost a lot of weight from being on his own for a week, and he also had burns from melted tar on his paws and stomach. Laura thinks he escaped the flames by climbing on their roof.
We were right before we found him that if there was ever a cat that could have survived this, it was Kermit, and that cat is a champion. Yeah. He is a champion.
Yeah.
So yeah. He's going to get as much wet food as he wants.
Yeah.
The vet says Kermit will make a full recovery, and the Smiths, well, they're staying in a trailer now in a friend's driveway in Chico. They're moving into an apartment next month.
You know, but we're lucky compared to a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't have this good ending.
Yeah,
it's
didn't
awful.
You know, they didn't get their pets back. They didn't get their... They literally lost everything. So we're very thankful and very conscious of how...
We lost everything, but not our cat.
Yeah.
You can see pictures of Kermit on thetakeaway.org. Listening to The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. When Democrats took back the House of Representatives earlier this month, part of their success was in traditionally conservative districts flipping from red to blue. And nowhere was that change more evident than in the birthplace of Richard Nixon, Orange County, California. Democrats won all seven of the county's congressional districts, delivering a heavy blow to the California Republican Party. And to talk about how significant this is, we turn to Mark Z. Baraback, a politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
So, Mark, give us a sense of how significant is this? Because we just said they won all seven of the county's congressional districts. What is the significance of that for Orange County?
Well, it's a huge deal. I was straining for metaphors. I came up with ideas like, you know, busloads of Yankee fans going to Fenway Park to cheer the Red Sox, or Coke serving Pepsi in their corporate cafeteria. And I was goofing on Twitter, and I'm hearing from people, no, that doesn't capture the moment. I mean, I guess hell freezing over is about what comes closest. There's nowhere that symbolized conservatism and republicanism like Orange County. And all metaphors aside, this will be the first time since the 1930s that the fountainhead, the wellspring of conservatism in America, will have no Republican representation in Congress, which is huge.
Mark, I want to talk a lot about what it is that drove that change. What was it? Was it politics? Was it climate change? Was it the fires? What was it?
It was politics and demographics mainly. I mean, just to go back a little bit of history, Orange County was settled by folks who came there. It was a small farming community. A lot of conservative Midwesterners moved there. A lot of white flight from Los Angeles. These were people who owned homes, who were involved in their churches, who were very fierce cold warriors. They worked in the military installations. They worked in aerospace, those sorts of industries. And Orange County began changing when the things that attracted those folks, beautiful scenery, great climate, good schools, safe neighborhoods, started attracting people from all over the world. You had Asians, you had, in particular, Latinos, as we call them in California. Some folks say Hispanics. And that changed, and the demographics changed, but in large part, Orange County did not change. There was a backlash. Famously, we had Proposition 187, which was going to take away public services from illegal immigrants. It was blocked by the courts, but that in turn prompted a backlash and energized a lot of folks. And Orange County changed, but a lot of politicians didn't. They continued playing to this conservative base as the county was changing out under them. And lastly, and not leastly, was Donald Trump. People on both sides, Democrat and Republican, will tell you if Donald Trump had not won, these seats would not have flipped. These would not have been competitive races, but they were, and they did.
And is your sense that the GOP will be able to rebound from this? I mean, I know in 2016 that largely voted for Hillary Clinton, not Donald Trump. Is that right?
It voted for Hillary Clinton first time since 1936. That is the huge question. Is this a permanent change? Is this a one-off? We won't know until 2020 or frankly beyond if Democrats hang on to those seats.
And overall, are Democrats invigorated by this win?
Very much so. It's beyond, I think, most of their wildest dreams. I mean, they said they were going to compete there. A lot of folks were cynical and doubted they could do it. So, yes, they are plainly ecstatic. One last thing. 53 members in California's congressional delegation. Republicans are now down to, at most, one still undecided, 8. That means they don't have enough people to field a softball team.
Wow, that's a staggering number. Mark Z. Baraback, politics writer for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks again, Mark.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to Babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, Babbel.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Hate in America is on the rise. According to an FBI report released last week, incidents of hate crimes increased 17% between 2016 and 2017. And the details on how that hate festers and plays out are the subject of a new documentary series from ProPublica and PBS Frontline called Documenting Hate.
I think a lot of young men that we've met, they come from a place of being emotionally distraught to start with. And they're looking for answers, and these are the answers that they find online. And soon enough, they're in a real-world group.
Looking at the rise of white supremacy, the series chronicles white nationalist groups and one group in particular known as Adam Waffen.
Some of them are former service members, and they say that they grew disaffected and disillusioned with the wars that they were fighting abroad. I think some of them feel like they had been basically forgotten by the government and sort of abandoned.
A.C. Thompson is the reporter behind the investigation, and he begins his documentary with a look at how hate groups have changed since violence erupted in Charlottesville back in August of 2017.
What we see is that the movement, the white power movement, sort of goes off the radar. The rallies they're having are smaller. The turnout they have for events are smaller. But what we know from our reporting is that a lot of these people decided to go underground. There's a whole contingent of the white power movement that's out there today that says, hey, we don't want to show our faces. We don't want people to know our identities. We don't want people to know what we're doing. And what we want to do is we want to work in small groups or as individuals to go out and commit acts that will spread fear, that will spread chaos, and will eventually lead to the collapse of the government and allow us to wage the race war that we dream of waging. We've seen this be a big current in the white power movement before in the 80s and 90s. There was a whole paramilitary side of it that sort of culminated with Tim McVeigh blowing up the Oklahoma City federal building in 1995. So there was a very militarized side to the white power movement then that was kind of different than the Klan. We're seeing that come back again. And people are taking those ideas from the 80s and 90s and saying, hey, it's not about a political party. It's not about burning a cross. It's not about any of that stuff. It's really about the gun. And it's really about us working in small groups or as individuals to go out and commit horrific acts.
You're following, we mentioned in the introduction, you're following a specific group. Tell us who Adam Waffen are.
So this group was founded in 2015 in Florida, and basically it was an outgrowth of a neo-Nazi fascist forum that people from around the world were communicating on. On that forum, there was a small group of people led by a young man named Brandon Russell who decided to start their own little army. And Brandon Russell was a Florida National Guardsman. He was 22 years old. And in the middle of 2017, he was arrested by police for building explosives. In his house, he had numerous weapons, radioactive material, very, very high-powered explosives, and detonators, fuses, etc. He also had two dead bodies because his roommate, who had also been a neo-Nazi, had murdered, allegedly, two of their neo-Nazi cellmates, members of their group. So it was a pretty insane and bloody and terrifying scene, particularly when you understand that Brandon Russell, the founder of this group, had terrorist manuals in his house. He had manuals about basically blowing things up. And the federal authorities eventually charged him with explosives possession, his roommate charged with double homicide, and it keeps going. So what you see after that is the group at that time had about 60 members, from what we understand, and its ranks actually swelled after that and then swelled again after Charlottesville. We're now finding some links between Robert Bowers, the man who shot up the synagogue allegedly in Pittsburgh, and the Adam Waffen Division, that he may have been communicating with members of their circle online. And so what my fear is that we'll continue to see these acts of people who are either inspired by organized groups like Adam Waffen or spin off from groups like Adam Waffen, going in with a gun to a church, a synagogue, a mosque, and doing immense, immense harm.
How successful have they been in recruiting members of the military or former members of the military? Because you mentioned there seems to be a pattern there.
The group has recruited at least 7 current or former military members. Brandon Russell, the founder, was a Florida National Guardsman in the Army. We know of several other people who were active duty, either in the Marines or the Army, and then several people who were former combat veterans. And what those military-trained people are doing is they're doing weapons training, combat training for other members of the group.
Let's talk about control here. Who is looking at these groups, if you will, these hate groups? What does law enforcement have to say? And are these considered domestic terrorists?
You know, the domestic terrorist thing is, it's pretty hazy. There's not really federal law covering that. I mean, basically the terrorism stuff works that if you're you get a terrorism charge when you're connected with an overseas group. I think these people fit under that term as a broad rubric. What we know is that there is increasing federal attention from the FBI towards these groups. But we're also hearing from the Department of Homeland Security that people there do not feel prepared for this mission to deal with white extremism in America.
How is this? Let me ask you this question, because how is it different dealing with white extremism in America as opposed to dealing with an international threat, if you will?
You know, it's totally different, right? So this is the thing, is you have to have subject matter expertise. You have to have people who can infiltrate these groups. You have to have people who are literate in sort of emerging social media platforms and communications technologies. You have to have people who can go into online chats and say the right things and use the right lingo and not come across as a Fed or as an infiltrator. I mean, so you need to be immersed in that particular noxious subculture, and you need to be tracking it diligently. And ultimately, you have to have people inside these groups in one way or another. So it's a totally different deal, and you have to have that particular expertise. You also have to know, if somebody says, hey, I'm really into Tim McVeigh, that's signifying something quite specific. It's signifying I'm down to kill 168 American people, including 19 children. If they say, I'm really into the Turner Diaries, what they're saying is, this is a book that was written by a white supremacist that has inspired dozens of terrorist attacks. And they're saying, I'm down for terrorism. These are things that don't, you know, the Tim McVeigh thing's pretty obvious, but a lot of these other things are not quite as obvious.
A.C. Thompson is a ProPublica reporter and correspondent for PBS Frontline. Thanks, A.C.
Thank you.
The Frontline and ProPublica joint investigation documenting hate, New American Nazis, premieres tomorrow, Tuesday, November 20th at 9, 8 Central on PBS stations and online. It's Thanksgiving week, and that means many of us are packing our bags, double-checking our flights, and preparing to gather with family to cook and, of course, to eat. But not all Americans have the same type of access to nutritional food. In fact, in 2017, roughly 40 million Americans didn't have enough money or resources to feed their family. That's 12% of all Americans. For Black households, that number jumps to 22%. For Hispanic households, it's 18%. And while the majority of farm workers in the United States are people of color, 95% of farm owners in the U.S. are white. Takeaway producer Rob Gunther recently spent some time at a farm in upstate New York where a group of food activists of color are working to challenge this disparity. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tanzina.
So tell me about this farm. What was it that made you interested in heading up there?
So I heard about this farm. It's owned and operated by young farm workers of color. And I know that when I think about where I get my food from, it's so easy to take for granted the fact that we can just go to the grocery store, get whatever we need, and never think about it again. But I know that's not true for so many people. And when I heard about Soulfire Farm and what they're trying to do, it really made me question these questions of who we think of when we say American farmers. You know, so many times we hear about the government giving subsidies to farmers. The president will get out there and say, we're going to help our farmers in trade wars and tariffs. And without even thinking about it, this image comes to mind. And I think the image for a lot of people is of a white person farming. So Soulfire Farm, it's about a half hour outside of Albany. They work on 7 acres of land, growing all sorts of vegetables. They raise chickens. And I made the trip up there on a rainy Saturday morning in October.
So you get up there, it's harvest season, right? What are they farming?
When I was there, they were taking up these giant sweet potatoes.
Since we're digging up the sweet potatoes, it doesn't matter if this stuff is pierced. We already mowed most of it, so we don't have to worry about the vines themselves.
And this is all happening right outside of New York City. It was fascinating.
So you talked to Leah Penniman, and she's the co-founder of Soulfire Farms. Let's listen to what she had to say.
We are a people of color-led community farm that's dedicated to ending racism and injustice in the food system.
That sounds like a pretty ambitious thing to want to do. How are they going about doing that?
It is ambitious. It's a huge project. And I think that Leah, the way she described it, they tailor it to three specific focuses.
The first is to grow food in a sustainable Afro-Indigenous manner and provide that food to over 400 members in our community who otherwise would not have access. The second thing is education. We're trying to train up the next generation of Black and Brown farmers. And the third and final project that we're working on is reparations of land and resources.
What they're really trying to address is the question of access to food. And even more than that, they're trying to address like how this agriculture system reflects the same racial disparities that we see across any other American institution.
That's what strikes me as so interesting, the philosophy behind what they're trying to do and who they're trying to encourage to get involved in farm work.
I think for these farmers, you can kind of see how race impacts every aspect of life. And food is something that, because so many of us take it for granted, I think it's easy not to see the injustice there. But the injustice is there. I talked to assistant farm manager Damaris Miller. She told me that this was a big driver of her getting into agriculture in the first place.
One of the challenges in our community that gets really invisibilized, diet-related illness and disease is the leading cause of death amongst Black folks, especially in communities of color. And so if Black lives matter, then eating nutritious food has to matter too.
You know, when you go to visit Soulfire Farm, there's volunteers when I went there. There were community members stopping by to drop off homemade jars of jam. Besides from just attracting people, in terms of actually giving young people the technical training that they're going to need to make agriculture a career, I talked to people like Ceci Pineda, who before this was living in New York City, and Letitia Wyatt from South Carolina.
I'd done a program here. Soulfire runs these programs called the Black and Latinx Farmers Immersions, expanded to include other people of color, but who are interested in learning more, deepening their farming skills, or I've realized for a lot of people, it's also going deeper into food justice and they start to work on other issues. Maybe it's policy or working on like community nutrition, community health.
I did the Black and Latinx Farmers Immersion 2 years ago, and that's what got me started farming. I'm definitely still continuing my education, and we do so much work around acknowledging Afro-Indigenous roots in farming. Social inequality produces health inequalities in different populations of people.
So, Rob, what your reporting is showing, basically, is that there's a big disconnect between who's eating food and who's growing food.
Exactly. And, you know, to better understand that gap, I sat down with Soulfire Farm's co-founder, Leah Penniman, who you heard back at the top of this interview. And she started out by explaining how Soulfire got its start.
Soulfire Farm, the land itself, chose us in 2006. And then we spent about 4 years building the house, building up the soil, which was badly degraded, the barn and so on. So we opened Soulfire and moved here onto this land in 2010. When I started farming, and I was all about it because it seemed like the perfect intersection of social justice and environmental justice, I would go to all these farming conferences and the presenters were white, mostly white men. All the books were written by white folks. So I really believed that organic farming was invented by Europeans. And I started to feel like a race traitor and felt pulled to other causes. You know, maybe I should get involved in housing issues or police violence. There's really a big myth that Black and brown folks' only relationship to agriculture has been through enslavement and sharecropping and not through tens of thousands of years of noble innovation in agriculture. And so a big part of writing Farming While Black was to debunk that and to really show the ways that we have made significant contributions to sustainable farming over time and that we do have a rightful place of belonging to the land and on the land.
One thing that jumped out from the book is that you talk about how Black farm ownership has decreased from 14 to 2% since the 1920s. What accounts for this? What mm-hmm. brought us to this, to that decline?
So such a powerful question. You know, Malcolm X talked about all revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. And so we know that land certainly provides sustenance, but land also provides a sense of ownership and self-determination. And I don't think any of your listeners would agree that it's right for 98% of the rural land in this country to be owned by white people when we're a half, you know, people of color country. And so there's a huge disparity in addition to government discrimination. So if you went to get a loan or you went for some crop insurance or for technical assistance, time and again, you'd be denied. In the early 1980s, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights declared that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was the number one driver of Black land loss and would be to blame for the extinction of the Black farmer.
So you wrote this book. What are you calling the next generation to do? How do you go from 2% back to a higher number?
Well, I think the part that we need to take responsibility for as Black farmers is healing from the legacy of inherited trauma, of all the oppression we've experienced on land. So this book really uses we language for the returning generation of Black farmers. It's about learning our noble history, overcoming our fears, trying it out, accessing the resources that we have, and engaging in mutual aid. That's our responsibility. I think it's the job of white America and the rest of the United States in general to really take the boot off our necks, because we still have disparities in terms of how government money is distributed by race, to farmers. We still have food apartheid, which is a legacy of redlining, where your zip code essentially determines your access to everything, your education, your housing, your food. And we still have the exploitation of farm workers. And so we need to make substantive policy change, corporate change, so that we as Black and Brown farmers, we're ready to go, so that we have the resources and we have the ability to go ahead and make our dreams come true.
That was Takeaway producer Rob Gunther in conversation with Leah Penniman, co-founder of Soulfire Farm in Grafton, New York, and author of Farming While Black. Rob, thanks for bringing us that story.
Thanks, Tanzina.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.